From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
If you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want in this town.
Everybody thinks show business is really, really all white lights,
peaches
and cream.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood. Hollywood.
This week on The Business, former Senator Rick Santorum wants to make faith-based movies that are also entertaining.
Unfortunately, in a lot of the films that have faith in them, it looks awkward, it looks forced, it looks preachy.
Plus, the man behind Despicable Me 2 on making big animated hits for bargain prices. But first on the Hollywood News Banter, the industry reels from bombs at the box office. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
I'm joined by my banter buddy, John Horn of Los Angeles Times. Hello, John.
Hello, Kim.
So, John, I think we can agree there's been a lot of ink already spilled on 2013 as the summer of the box office bomb.
A lot of red ink, I would say. It's been I think as some of us, including probably you and me, predicted, there's going to be some very unfortunate films this summer. I think the thing that's astonishing is the degree to which some of these very expensive movies are failing. And I think at the same time, the degree to which some smaller movies are succeeding. So it has been a huge gap between the haves and have-nots. But the big studio movies largely are going down in flames.
I think the biggest loser right now looks to be the Lone Ranger, but it is hardly alone. There's After Earth from Sony, as well as White House Down from Sony, RIPD from Universal, and I think they knew that one was going to be a bomb for a long time and at least had the virtue of not making a huge marketing spend, throwing good money after bad. And the ones that seem to have failed are the ones that are attempts to initiate new franchises. The ones with digits after them, like Fast and Furious 6, huge hit. But the ones like Lone Ranger or Pacific Rim hoping to start something just really fell short in a way that has to have the studios searching their souls, assuming they have those souls to search.
Yeah, I'm not sure Hollywood is that good about, you know, postmortems or looking for lessons learned. But if I were a studio executive, I would be less interested in why movies didn't work this summer and instead look at the movies that did work. And they were generally much cheaper. They generally had a targeted audience and they were discovered by moviegoers rather than kind of jammed down the throats of moviegoers by the marketing departments. And I'd cite four films. Despicable Me 2, which has a worldwide gross of $600 million and counting. The Conjuring, a $20 million horror film that opened to almost $42 million. The Purge, a movie that cost $3.5 million, that so far has taken in $64 million. And I'd also put in Now You See Me, a kind of magic crime story made for about $78 million. That's over $200 million worldwide. And I guess we could also throw in The Heat, because that appealed to women. And that movie cost $40 million to make, and it's over $133 million at the box office. So those movies have succeeded, I think, much bigger than anybody expected them to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to take a while for the studios to even react to what's happened. It takes, you know, 18 months at the minimum to start a movie and finish it, especially when there's a lot of effects to be done. So you won't see an instant change, but we do have a very crowded calendar again next year and the year after that even. I mean, that is one of the issues here is the sheer number of movies fighting with very little space in between when audiences are interested in a Despicable Me and it can play for 3 or 4 weekends. Then anything in its path is probably going to get hurt, especially if it's aimed at that same audience. So we just saw Comic-Con wrap up, and it was business as usual. They're announcing these big movies, Warner Brothers confirming Superman versus Batman, and they're promoting another Spider-Man. And, you know, but remember that, John, I'm sure you do, last year Pacific Rim made a big noise there, and before that, Jonah Hex, and those are movies, you know, you get very deceived when you are playing to that fanboy audience because that alone is not necessarily good enough. You have to do, as you were mentioning earlier, a better story and something that really that the audience can discover.
Yeah, what a novel concept. You actually have to make movies that people are interested in seeing.
Speaking of which, Spike Lee, you know, Zach Braff, who was a guest on our show and stood up for himself in a very game fashion, he took a lot of heat for going to Kickstarter. He nonetheless raised the money he wanted to raise to make his movie. And Spike Lee apparently just found out about this quite recently. And he has launched a Kickstarter campaign seeking $1.25 million for a project that he is not very specific about. And, you know, it's kind of funny. Zach Braff took so much heat as a guy who was connected and made money in Hollywood and was rich. And yet it's been relatively muted about Spike Lee. And for me, John, Spike's presentation, far short of what Zach Braff did. At least, you know, he made a compelling video and explained to you what movie he wanted to make.
Yeah, Spike Lee just kind of came off as a little bit angry and a little bit clueless. I mean, it's as if you've watched the video, it's as if he didn't know Kickstarter existed until a couple of weeks ago. We should say the campaign is off to a very poor start. He has about 3 weeks to go on the campaign. He's only raised $215,000, $10,000 of which came from Steven Soderbergh, who, for giving that gift, will get to sit courtside with Spike Lee at a Knicks game. I think there's a real problem with Spike Lee's presentation. It doesn't make it seem as if he's passionate about the project. As you said, he's kind of cryptic about what it's about. And I think that's probably why he's having such a hard time raising more than a couple of nickels.
Meanwhile, in other fundraising endeavors, John, I think you and I both noticed something that CAA, the agency, has launched with a lot of Hollywood celebrities, industry celebrities, as well as regular celebrities, and many of them CAA clients.
Yeah, this is the kind of the hyper version of the silent auction that you would see at some charitable dinners where you bid on, maybe you get a script signed by some actor. CAA is working with a very worthwhile charity. It's called Communities in Schools, and it seeks at-risk kids in high school, make sure they graduate, complete their studies. Very worthwhile charity. And they are going to probably raise a ton of money because they are selling off access to some of Hollywood's most powerful people.
For example, Disney chairman and CEO Bob Iger for a, well, it's unclear what the cost of this, you will have lunch with Bob Iger. It is valued on the site as $10,000 worth. It doesn't specify how long the lunch is, but you get to have at least presumably an hors d'oeuvre with him for that money. Stacy Snyder from DreamWorks, a lunch also, minimum bid $750, and valued, I don't know by whom, at $5,000. Paul Haggis, if the Scientologists wanted to sit him down, somebody could bid on a lunch with him, which is valued at $5,000.
I think if they really wanted to capture the true Hollywood experience, they would add to the auction such activities as cell phone throwing with Russell Crowe or maybe a paparazzi avoidance course with Britney Spears and Sean Penn. So those would be the kind of the true show business experiences that I think would raise a ton of money.
And given that it is a charity, we can hope that a ton of money is raised. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kim.
That's John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. And you can keep up with us on Twitter. My handle is at Kim Masters. John's is at JG Horn. And our producer, Darby Maloney, is at Darby KCRW. Coming up later in the show, Despicable Me 2 is one of the summer's biggest hits. We meet the mild-mannered executive who's built one of the most profitable production companies in town. But first, former presidential candidate Rick Santorum gets into the movie business. You probably remember Republican Senator Rick Santorum from that big field aspiring to be the GOP nominee for president in 2012. He was the one with the sweater vest. Santorum was a two-term senator from Pennsylvania and, before that, a member of the House of Representatives. An outspoken conservative on issues from abortion to gay marriage, Santorum, who still harbors presidential aspirations, has gotten into the movie business. He recently took a job as CEO of Dallas, Texas-based Echolite Studios, a new film company that plans to make and distribute high-quality movies for families of faith. The business producer, Darby Maloney, recently reached Santorum at his home in Pennsylvania to discuss why he took the job.
I mean, it's obvious to me that the popular culture has a huge impact on our society. And for conservatives, for, in my opinion, far too long, we've sort of retreated from that arena, in many cases tried to just criticize and put walls up, particularly for our family, to some of the content that was coming out in the popular culture. And that's a losing proposition. So I felt that it was an opportunity for me to engage in something I care about, which is the future of our country. I think it was one of the great Greek philosophers who said, "Give me the storytellers and I will control the country in a generation." And in some respects, that's exactly what those who have been the storytellers of our country, and primarily out of Hollywood, but other places, but primarily Hollywood, they have been writing the story of our country. And in some respects, that's been a good thing. In other respects, it's not. And I think this is an opportunity for not just me, but hopefully a lot of other people to engage in that storytelling, respect, as I do, the great storytelling that is being done in some places out on the coast, but offer a little bit of an alternative vision for the country through storytelling to the company that I'm working on.
Now, you had an interesting quote, because there isn't an absence of faith-based or Christian films in the popular culture right now. They're not as mainstream as, like, The Avengers or something, but right. There are Christian films. And you said something when the announcement was made about you taking this position, that some of these Christian films have had, quote, terrible acting, horrible editing, they are not entertaining, they're preachy. Why do you think that is?
Well, because they are. it's unfortunate when you talk to Christian audiences and you ask them if they read Christian books. And, of course, the answer is, of course, yes. Other than the Bible, there's a lot of popular novels and studies and treatises on different takes on theology. There's all sorts of literature out there that's really well done. And Christian music, which over the last 25, 30 years, again, has sort of developed a genre of music that is rather eclectic. You have Christian rock, you have New Age, you have traditional folk and classic. I mean, it's a very robust genre of music that Christians are out there performing in the popular culture and, in a sense, quote, competing for ears of the public. You mentioned Christian film, and they give you a blank stare. I mean, you know, they'll throw Passion of the Christ out. But beyond that, there really isn't a whole lot. And what's been out there that has been popular, a couple of the movies, have really not been the kind of quality that most audiences expect. And you're not going to get people in the seats. And frankly, it's not as entertaining. I mean, people want to be entertained, as well they should, when they shell out 10 or 15 bucks for a movie. And they want quality. And, of course, they want to be moved in some capacity. And so even films that were so supposedly faith-oriented, one of the most recent was Soul Surfer, very, very light on the faith side. I mean, it's not that it wasn't a good picture. It's not that it wasn't a good story. Not that it wasn't an uplifting tale. But the role that faith played in that young girl's life is really brushed aside and minimized. And that's not the truth. The role that faith played was huge in her life. But to gain popular audience and to not offend some people, they scrub that out. What we want to do is be honest. I don't want to preach to anybody. I don't want to do the pastor's job. But faith is a very natural thing in people's lives. And unfortunately, in a lot of the films that have faith in them, it looks awkward. It looks forced. It looks preachy. And that isn't true. It isn't entertaining. And it isn't reflective of how faith really does interject itself in the lives of people.
You're listening to The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking with former Senator Rick Santorum, now CEO of the new faith-based film company, Echo Light Studios. The company is based in Dallas, Texas, where Santorum says it's been pretty easy to raise money for this type of film.
I can say, surprisingly, it was not hard to raise the money. And in fact, we're oversubscribed. So our objective right now is to start small and to work our way up. I mean, we're not going to be competing with the big boys. We're going to start with, you know, $2 to $3 million films. And we're going to have probably a lot of partnerships. We'll do some co-productions. But we're going to start with small films and work to put every dollar we can on the screen.
And how about, like, when you go about finding scripts, cast, crew, directors, will you be tapping people in Hollywood? Will you be
Absolutely. Talking
to the talent
Absolutely.
Agencies here?
Yeah. No, I mean, right now, you know, we're in development on three projects right now. And one project, we're looking for a screenwriter. And we're talking to people in Hollywood. We're talking to people all over the country. So we just finished a movie that is on a true story about a basketball player in Southern Illinois, which will be coming out next year. And we had some people on the film, a couple names you may know, Patrick Warburton, Lauren Holly, Corey Lindley, some others in the Disney world. And to so many of the folks who were on that set, the response was, gee, it's nice to work on a movie that, I can go home and tell my mom and not get looked askance because I'm making a movie that's not necessarily something that she would approve of. Look, actors and actresses want to make good quality product, but it's also they want to make good redeeming content, too. They want to make good stories that are uplifting and that they want their kids to be able to see and not be ashamed that they're in the film or not feel uncomfortable. Maybe not ashamed. They wouldn't do it if they were ashamed, but be uncomfortable, that they carried a part like that. So I think there's opportunities for everybody. And, the folks who are on that film, frankly, some of them are not Christians and some of them are not, even if they are Christians, are not necessarily, strong believers. But we're looking for good talent, and hopefully through the experience of working with us, it'll give them a moment of reflection in their own life.
You talked a lot about making movies for families. Obviously, families are changing a lot with gay marriage here in California. Is that a subject you deal with, or mostly we're seeing traditional families in the Echo Light pictures?
Yeah, there'll be traditional families. I mean, look, we're going to be very clear about the values that we embrace, and we're not going to be making films that are going to be controversial in that respect and trying to point the finger on anybody or any issue. We're going to, with probably a couple of exceptions, at least certainly one exception with the movies we have right now, they're not any political edge to them. One of the movies we are going to be working on is a movie that actually is around the Victims' Rights Amendment to the Constitution. So there is that political element that we'll be dealing with in one of the films. We're going to make movies that are inspiring, uplifting, and are consistent with the Judeo-Christian principles that we believe are essential to a great and healthy country.
Mark Burnett and the History Channel had tremendous success recently with a series about the Bible.
Yeah.
Is TV something that you all at Echo Light would look at?
Absolutely. I mean, in fact, we are in conversation with multiple networks right now about not only placing some of our films that we have in the can, some that we have in production, and potentially doing some work with those television stations and co-producing movies for TV.
Your old colleague, Senator Christopher Dodd, is also in the movie business in a way as the head of the Motion Picture Association of America. What do you make, now that you're sort of out of Washington, you're not quite in Hollywood, but what is the Washington-Hollywood connection?
There is no question that what goes on in Washington is in large part dictated by what goes on in the culture. And obviously a huge cultural influence are motion pictures. So it's no surprise that when Hollywood, whether it's the White House Correspondents' Dinner or some other events that happen in D.C., when Hollywood meets Washington, Washington really pays attention. Why? Because they have an impact. I always say when people ask me, how does someone in politics get involved in a movie company and secondly in a faith-based movie company? And I said, well, to be a politician, you got to have a little entertainer in you. I mean, there has to be a little showmanship. Otherwise, you're not going to do a very good job communicating your message. And there has to be part minister or there's an element of belief and passion that comes from what your core beliefs are. And so they actually blend together pretty well for a job like this.
Well, Senator, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Rick Santorum is a former U.S. senator from Pennsylvania and presidential candidate. He is now the CEO of Echo Light Studios, a faith-based film company in Dallas, Texas.
To hear outtakes from our conversation with Rick Santorum, go to our website, kcrw.com/thebusiness. After a short break, one of the most successful but least well-known executives in animation talks about winning the trust of Dr. Seuss's widow.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. As we discussed earlier with John Horn of the Los Angeles Times, this summer movie season will be remembered for its massively expensive bombs. There's also been fierce competition among animated features, including Monsters University, Epic, Turbo, and the upcoming Smurfs 2 and Planes. There have been hits and misses, but standing out in the pack for both box office grosses and profitability is Despicable Me 2, featuring the voices of Steve Carell and Kristen Wiig.
Yeah, what you just saw there was a little something new I've been working on. It's a combination of a jujitsu, Krav Maga, Aztec warfare, and crumping.
Okay, that's weird. Why are you here?
On assignment from Silas. I'm your new partner. Yay!
This sequel to the 2010 hit Despicable Me comes from Illumination Entertainment, founded by our next guest, Chris Meledandri. Before that, he was head of Fox Animation, where he oversaw production on Ice Age and Horton Hears a Who. Illumination is only 6 years old and already has an impressive track record with hits including Hop and The Lorax, in addition to the two Despicable movies. The company works quickly and efficiently and keeps its budgets far lower than the competition. Despicable Me 2, for example, cost about $76 million, while a Pixar or DreamWorks Animation film costs more than twice that much. That means big profit for Illumination and its parent, Universal Pictures. As of now, the movie has grossed nearly $600 million worldwide.
When I went off to start this new company with Universal, I got to start from scratch. The goal was consistent profitability. It was not blockbuster success. First of all, it's a tough life to try to say that every time you're going to go out and make a movie, it's going to be a blockbuster. I mean, it's the odds are definitely working against you. But more importantly, I believed that if we set realistic goals for how we wanted the films to perform, that it would enable us to take greater risk.
How can you do it faster? Like, what do you think is the difference there between a film that gestates much longer and your film? And how do you know that you're not losing something by going faster?
Well, the area where we tend to go faster is actually in the earliest phases of pre-production. So we've been able to really focus our energy through the script and visual development period. And we've been able to pull that together and pull the picture up onto reels, which is, you know, what happens after the storyboards are assembled. We've been able to get through that phase quite a bit faster than our competition.
Now, let's step back for just a second in terms of your development in all of this. I read something that somewhat confused me, and maybe I didn't quite get it, that you had sort of became interested in animation while you were working on Cool Runnings, which was the Jamaica bobsled team movie. Was there a connection there, or did I just get that wrong?
The connection there was I was fortunate enough to be an executive producer on the late Don Steele's movie, that Cool Runnings, which I think, you know, to this day is one of my favorite movies that I worked on. It was released as a Disney movie under the Disney label, which started to make people think that I knew something about family films, because Disney obviously was always the family label. And when I went to Fox, they saw me as a family films guy. The truth about animation was that I had no interest in animation. I grew up in a family that were voracious film goers, but more along the lines of, you know, Antonioni and the French New Wave and
right.
Woody Allen. I grew up in New York City in the 70s, and my parents were taking me to, you know, Easy Rider as opposed to a Disney animated film. I wasn't allowed to watch television on the weekends. I saw no animation growing up. My mother hated Disney. So the first animation I saw was really Miyazaki films when my first son, you know, started getting old enough.
No, we're still going in the rarefied environment.
Yeah,
there.
No, I know. And but I was working on a lot of family films when I got to Fox. I was working with John Hughes, and my boss at the time, one of my bosses, Bill Mechanic, had started an animation division and liked me and asked me if I could help on the story work there. And so I jumped in, and that first movie was a traditionally animated movie called Anastasia.
Right.
Which for me, it was like speaking a foreign language. I didn't really understand anything about the process. And from there, I went on to a film called Titan AE, which you know, had $100 million written down of Fox's money because
it did not
failed,
do well.
Failed
yeah.
so badly. So my early years in animation were confused and painful. But while I was working on Titan, I found this little group of about 40 or 50 animators in Westchester County, New York, called Blue Sky. And I started to develop some ideas and some films with them and to do as a CG movie, but, you know, just really without any clear idea of if anything would come of this. And ultimately, I brought them the script of Ice Age.
Obviously, Ice Age was a pretty radically different from the stuff that went before.
Yeah, Ice Age was, you know, it was a classic story of going from complete failure to making one of the most profitable films in the history of Fox. So the contrast of my life, you know, from Titan to Ice Age was quite severe. And then I was very fortunate because from that point on at Fox, we had a string of hit movies.
Now let's talk about Dr. Seuss. I recall Universal actually making a version of, the Grinch and then Cat in the Hat, which was Mike Myers. And I'm just not even going to hold back. One of the worst things I've ever seen on a screen. And I remember hearing that Dr. Seuss's widow was very upset with that film for every good reason. And yet you managed to court her and win her over. How did that work out, Audrey Geisel?
Right. Well, When I first approached her about doing Horton Hears a Who, the Cat in the Hat had not been finished and not come out. And she quite liked The Grinch. She really loved Jim Carrey's performance. And the film was tremendously successful domestically. I think it made almost $280 million. So she was open to having these conversations about Horton. But after Cat in the Hat came out and she then decided that she no longer wanted to do any adaptations of her late husband's work.
I'd heard that she'd screened it and was weeping in the screening room.
She was really, really upset. And so I let a few months pass, and then I wrote her a letter. And in the letter, I said, look, we have an opportunity here, which is to repair the legacy of your late husband's work. And if we are able to make a movie, translate Horton into a film in animation and using this unique opportunity in CG animation to really respect and truly look to translate his work and capture the spirit of his work, then we can really repair some of the damage that has been done. And that opened her up. And that was, 8 or 9 years ago, and we've been working together ever since.
Is Johnny Depp had been interested in a biopic of Dr. Seuss? Is that still a going thing? Or
it's something that we're still working on. You know, it's tricky stuff because on one hand, you try so hard to have every conversation and every thought informed by the respect that, you know, that you have. And sometimes that fights what might be the most dramatic expression and the most accurate expression of a period in his life. And, you know, ultimately for me, that movie is about the creative process, and making a movie about the creative process is extremely difficult.
Yeah.
So that one I don't think will come into our record books, you know, in terms of the shortest time between development and production. It's more important to get that right than to do it quickly.
Chris Maledandri is the founder and CEO of Illumination Entertainment. The company's latest movie is Despicable Me 2. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to us anytime on demand with the KCRW smartphone apps. And you can hear the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. The show is produced and distributed by KCRW. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.